listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Kai Bird understands the dangers and seductions of the Middle East. It is, he writes, part of my identity. Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, coming of age between the Arabs and Israelis, 1956 to 1978, his magnificent memoir, is his attempt, he explains, to understand why the Middle East of my childhood seems stuck in endless conflict. Kai Bird grew up on the seam between Arabs and Israelis, an American in the heyday of American innocence and power. His father was a career foreign service officer, and Kai's childhood was spent growing up amongst the Israelis and Arabs of Palestine, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. Each day on his way to school, he was driven through the Mandelbaum Gate, where armed soldiers guarded the line separating Israeli-controlled West Jerusalem from Arab-controlled East. And he grew up in the midst of three major wars and three turbulent decades in the Middle East. This deeply felt and intimate account of a life spent between cultures reminds us, as Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld wrote, and I thought this was such a beautiful quote, that the path to peace passes through the gate of personal narrative. Kai Bird is the co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, which also won the National Book Critics Award for Biography and the Duff Cooper Prize for History in London. His other books, The Chairman, John J. McCloy, The Making of the American Establishment and The Color of Truth, McGeorge Bundy and William Bundy, Brothers in Arms. He's also co-editor of Hiroshima's Shadow, Writings on the Denial of History and the Smithsonian Controversy. And in conversation with Kai Bird tonight is Nicholas Goldberg, editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial pages. Nick's a former Middle East bureau chief for Newsday, and in that position, he covered many stories, including the peace process in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, presidential elections in Iran, arms monitoring in Iraq, civil war in Algeria, and I always know that we're in good hands and we're bound to learn a lot when Nick is asking the questions. So please welcome Nick Goldberg and Kai Bird. Thank you.
Good evening. Is my mic on? Yes. Sounds like it. So, thank you for coming out tonight. I'm especially pleased to be here, particularly pleased to be here today with Kai, because Kai and I have known each other for a long time, about 30 years, I think, a little more than 30 years. We worked together, starting when I was still in college at The Nation magazine. And I knew even then that he had this slightly romantic, exotic expat background. But I didn't really know any of the details. I didn't know much of it, much about it. Since then, although we didn't see all that much of each other in the intervening 30 years, our lives have overlapped in certain ways, because about 40 years after Kai lived in Jerusalem, I moved to the Middle East myself, and I lived in Jerusalem also. My kids went to the same school that Kai had gone to 40 years earlier, you know, we walk the same streets that he writes about in the book. So I'm hoping that in tonight's conversation, one of the things we'll talk about is how things have changed and how my experience of Jerusalem was different or similar than his. And, you know, I also spent time in Saudi Arabia, where Kai lived for a few years, and I spent time in Egypt and in Beirut as well. So we really did overlap. Now he's written this great memoir about his childhood. And it's fascinating because it goes back and forth between, you know, personal memoir and the history of the time. So I guess I thought the first question I'd ask you is, you know, you're not a famous person. You're not an important. You're not a particularly famous person, I should say.
Right.
You're not an important participant in a lot of the events that you're writing about. So what made you think that a memoir was the way to do this?
Well, I confess very early on in the book, in an author's note at the front, that I'm not a famous person, and that the only reason that my life as a child in the Middle East might be of some interest was that I'm sort of like the Woody Allen character Leonard Zelig in that funny movie where Zelig keeps popping up here and there at all the right or wrong moments in history to be a witness, and I'm the witness. But I should say that, you know, I actually avoided, despite this childhood history, I really consciously avoided writing about the Middle East very much in my 20s and 30s and 40s. And
but now that you're in your 70s.
Now that not quite there yet. But this book has been sort of gnawing at me for almost 20 years. During the when the 1990-91 Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War, erupted, it brought back a rush of childhood memories, and I felt I had to finally, you know, that it had been an abdication not to write about what I knew. And so I sat down and I wrote, in the midst of the war, an 800-word opinion piece for the Washington Post. And I described some of my earliest childhood memories, crossing Mandelbaum Gate, this very bleak, dark crossing point between what was a very much a divided East and West Jerusalem, where there were tank barriers, these cone-shaped concrete tank barriers that you had to weave in and out of, and there was rolls of barbed wire, and then two checkpoints, and first the Jordanians and then the Israelis. And I was, you know, a very privileged young observer of all this because my father had been posted to East Jerusalem, where he was assigned to what was then Jordan. And so we lived in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, which has now become a real focal point for the whole conflict. And yet I went to school in West Jerusalem, to the school that Nick later sent his kids. And so I went passed through Mandelbaum Gate every day. And so I described what it was like. I described one day we'd passed through the Jordanian checkpoint, and 100 feet later we were approaching the Israeli. My father was driving the car, and suddenly I cried out, "Daddy, Daddy, stop the car!" And he turned around, startled, and looked at me, and he saw I was groping at my T-shirt, trying to take off a button that a neighborhood friend in the Palestinian sector had given me, which had... It was a button with the image of Gamal Abdel Nasser on it. And I, in my childhood naivete, I knew that Gamal Abdel Nasser was a wildly popular Arab nationalist leader in Egypt and in Jordan and elsewhere, and that he was regarded as the bitter enemy of the Israelis. And so I thought I might be targeted, that the Israelis would... I had to get rid of that button quick. So I was very keenly aware at a very young age of the conflict, of the borders, of the divisions. And, you know, at one... So I told some of the stories about growing up in the Middle East in this op-ed piece. And then I had to, at the end of it, explain that I'd had sort of a metaphorical crossing of Mandelbaum Gate again when in my 20s I met my wife, Susan, and fell in love with her and married her. And she was not only Jewish, but the only daughter of two Holocaust survivors. And so I had to again sort of understand her family's story and what had happened, how her parents had survived. And, you know, all of these Holocaust survivors have fantastic survival stories, and so did Susan's parents. And I had to sort of cross both sides and see both sides in that sense, and to come to understand that you can't understand the Middle East without understanding the trauma and the horrors of the Shoah. So when I published this piece, this is a very roundabout way of explaining why this book came about, but When I published this piece in the Post, my lovely wife turned to me and she said, "Kai, that's the best piece of writing you've ever done. You should stop writing these boring history books and biographies and write about the Middle East and your childhood there." And I try to pay attention to her. She's very smart. But I ignored this advice for 20 years, but it was percolating in my head. And I then went on to finish my biography of John McCloy, a powerful Wall Street lawyer who I thought explained the workings of the American establishment. And then I went on to spend 7 years on the Bundy brothers, who explain in their lives why we got into the Vietnam War. And then I ended up spending 5 years working with my friend Martin Sherwin on a biography of Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb. And thus, ironically enough, I suddenly realized that in order to avoid writing about the dreaded Middle East and that emotional black hole, I had spent 25 years writing about men in the powerful American foreign policy establishment who were intimately involved with nuclear weapons, Hiroshima, the atomic bomb, and a very heavy subject. But I finally got around to getting back to the Middle East after finishing the Oppenheimer book, and I went back to the Middle East in 2007 to try to recall and remember what
happened. That wasn't the first time you'd been back there?
That wasn't the first time, but it was the first time in a long time. So.
So what was, when you came as a 3 or 4 year old or something, you came because your father was posted there as a right. as a young Foreign Service officer. What was the city like then? This was
1956, the summer of 56. And it was...
Remind us both what it looked and felt like to the extent that you know, because you do describe it in the book, and also what was its status politically at that point?
Well, politically it was... part of Jordan, the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. But Jerusalem...
East Jerusalem.
East Jerusalem was, and the West Bank. And but Jerusalem had this scar down the middle of it, which was the armistice line from the 1948 war. Just where the fighting had stopped, that's where the line was. And it was, you know, right through the heart of Jerusalem and through these neighborhoods, and there were fences and walls and barbed wire. We lived in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood just north of Damascus Gate, about less than a mile north. And we happened to live, initially I should say, we couldn't find housing, so we lived in the American Colony, which is a fixture of East Jerusalem even today. The American Colony was founded by a group of sort of evangelical Christians who wanted not to be missionaries, but they wanted just to live in the Holy Land. And this was they arrived in Jerusalem in the 1880s and started this colony. And eventually, over the decades, it turned into a very nice boutique hotel. And
I stayed there for a month.
It's a lovely place.
I could have stayed there with the whole 4 years. I would have been very happy.
Yes, it was a nice watering hole for journalists like you and diplomats and spies. And it just had beautiful architecture and a garden. And so we lived there for 2 months. And
you describe, in the book, you describe the city as still having, you know, goats and sheep walking through the streets and the call to prayer ringing out in the morning and church bells.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And it sounds like a tiny city. And frankly, it wasn't that different when I got there. I think right. in the years since I left, it's become much more crowded. There are a lot more cars. But yeah. When I was there, it was still unbuilt in large parts of the city.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Outside, I can remember as a child seeing camels walking by with loaded down with bales of hay or whatnot, and donkeys, and shepherds literally with flocks of sheep. And we actually lived right on, after we did find a house and moved out of the American colony, we lived right on no man's land under Mount Scopus, which is where Hebrew University had part of its facilities.
Let me interrupt you. Hebrew University, which you write about in the book, was an outpost. This was something that the Jews had built before the city was divided. So you had the hospital and the university sitting over there, and they had no way to get to them except...
Yeah, it was an island of Jewish
control.
So describe
these convoys that came by.
Oh, yeah, this was very scary. So there was this island of Israeli control on Mount Scopus, and we lived right underneath it, and there was no man's land with landmines, and at night occasionally you'd hear an explosion, and that probably meant a donkey had wandered in across no man's land and gotten blown up. And so the Israelis had to resupply. Under the armistice agreement, they had gotten the right to resupply their outpost on Mount Scopus every 2 weeks. And it was a very small place. There were no more than, I think, 50 or 60,000 Arabs living in East Jerusalem at the time. And we knew that the convoy was due when we began hearing the roar of the lion in the what do they call it, the biblical zoo
they still have that, a zoo of biblical animals.
Right. And so the biblical zoo had been evacuated after the 48 war, but they had not managed to get one lion out. So the lion was still there. And when he got hungry after 2 weeks, and part of the convoy's supplies was to bring in the carcass of a mule or a donkey for this hungry lion. So the convoy would then come by, and it was armored personnel carriers with just a slit. You could see the eyes of the Israeli soldiers driving this thing. And it would be escorted by Jordanian Arab legionnaires. And it was, a convoy of a dozen armored personnel carriers, and it rolled right past our house, and we'd stand on the sidewalk and see this. It was a very ominous kind of thing to see as a young boy.
And some years earlier, there'd been this horrible incident, right?
During the 48 War of Independence, as the Israelis call it, the Nakba, as the Palestinians call it, the disaster. There was a brutal massacre of a convoy of doctors going to Hadassah Hospital up by Mount Scopus.
Along that same path, by your
that
house.
That same road, right by our house in Sheikh Jarrah. And some 75 Jewish doctors and intellectuals were massacred, ambushed by Palestinian guerrillas. This was done apparently in retaliation just 2 days after a similar sort of incident called the massacre of Deir Yassin, of a Palestinian village about 7 miles away, where Israeli soldiers had gone in and there'd been civilians killed and such. So, this was part of Jerusalem's history too, a sort of tit for tat and an endless cycle of violence.
And what's one of the things that's interesting about the book is that this tit for tat that you read about in the papers now, you'll see, some Hamas guy shoots a rocket in from Gaza into southern Israel, and the Israelis respond, by killing a few people or bombing a building in Gaza. This tit-for-tat thing was going on when I was there in the 90s. It was going on when you were there in the 50s, and it was going on in 1948. And frankly, it was going on before that, in 1936 and 1929, right, during the riots and the uprising. I mean, it's been a constant thing in this endless effort to say, well, he started it. You can go back farther and farther and farther, and you never get to the beginning of it. And that's something, one of the things that I got from the book. Tell us a little bit about the history of Mandelbaum Gate. I thought that was kind of interesting.
When it was built, it was a beautiful, large structure made of this gleaming white Jerusalem stone. With nice archways and windows with arches. And it was, I think, a 3 or 4 story building. And it was built by the Mandelbaum family that had originally immigrated in the 1890s or so from Belo, Russia. And the original Mandelbaum had actually decided on that site because... up until then, many of the Jewish immigrants had been settling in West Jerusalem, some distance from the walled city, And Mandelbaum Gate was very close to Damascus Gate. And he wanted to, you know, stake out a little more territory and encourage more Jews to live closer to the old city. But ironically enough, it became a focal point for some of the fighting that occurred in the late 30s during the Arab Revolt of 1936 to 40, and subsequently during the 48 War, it became a full-fledged battle where Mandelbaum House was virtually destroyed and dozens of Israeli soldiers were killed when the house actually was exploded in the end. And so by 1956, when we arrived...
Excuse me. Mayor Giuliani takes his calls. But
this reminds me, I need to turn off my cell phone, too.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, usually I remember. Sorry about that. Go on. Really, I'm interested.
So...
I get it to turn
off. So when I arrived in 1956, Mandelbaum House was this ruin. One of the stone archways, was still standing from the garden. And otherwise, it was just it was a battlefield. There were old rusting tanks and armored personnel carriers on the side, and this very bleak crossing point where there are these two checkpoints. And you know, no Arabs traveled through Mandelbaum Gate to go to West Jerusalem, and no Israelis came east. It was only a few diplomats like my father and his dependents who could go back and forth on a daily basis. And then during high holidays and Christmas, the Jordanians would allow some tourists to come by on Christmas to come to see if they were coming from West Jerusalem. They'd allow them to come into East Jerusalem to go to the churches and such. But it was really restricted to diplomats.
Before we move off of Israel for the moment, and then we're going to come back to it in a little bit, I just want to ask you about this idea of Arabists in the State Department. This was a sort of a phenomenon of that time, and your parents, I think, or your father, kind of fell into that category. And you have a nice quote from Francis Fukuyama saying that the Arabists, who were this sort of elite core of Arabic-speaking foreign service officers, that they were an elite within an elite, more systematically wrong than any other group. And what does it mean exactly? And is this what your father was?
My father, you know, grew up in Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, and a small town then of 25,000 people, and he knew no Arabs, and I don't think he knew any Jewish Americans at the time. He joined the Foreign Service in 1952, and for some reason he was put on the Arab-Israeli desk for a short time and then assigned to Jerusalem. So when he arrived, he thought literally he was coming to the Holy Land, and he had a fascination with, you know, the archaeological digs that were there then trying to prove the existence of, you know, where Jesus might have walked. He was interested in that, and he came also initially with a sympathetic viewpoint to the Israeli story, you know, that the Jews had come back to Palestine to make the desert bloom. But very quickly, his views began to change when he saw what was going on the ground and the conflict. And this is an old story. He eventually opted for Arabic language training. He first actually wanted to do Hebrew first because he knew that it'd be good to have both, but that didn't work out. So he became an Arabic language specialist, and it is true, I quote the Fukuyama quote, because it is a charge that has been made against the State Department Arabists who, you know, if you spend, it takes 4 or 5 years at least to learn this language, it's very difficult, and if you invest that much of yourself into the language, inevitably you learn much of the history and the culture of the Arab world, and there's nowhere else, you know, that you end up spending your whole career there. And in this instance, in the Middle East, with it being so polarized, often, Henry Kissinger used to complain that the Arabists always gave him advice that he didn't want to hear. And this is true. They were diplomats serving at, you know, to carry out American policy, but they often, over the years, and this is true of my father, he grew very frustrated with the policy. He saw again and again that we were not taking steps to try to bring this conflict to an end, and that we were in some instances exacerbating the conflict. So,
The truth is, though, that even though he was privileged and you were privileged and allowed to cross back and forth across the green line, the armistice line, the reality is he lived on the eastern side.
Right.
And in Jerusalem to this day, or in Israel, I should say, and the territories to this day, there's an American embassy which sits in Tel Aviv, and the people who work in the American embassy and the ambassador tends to be very, very firmly pro-Israel, just like much of the U.S. Congress and most Americans. But the people who sit in the American consulate in Jerusalem are, in effect, the ambassadors to the Palestinians. And they have a very, very different point of view. They are Arabic speakers, not Hebrew speakers, by and large. And they are much more sympathetic to that to that cause. Okay. With that, let's... Oh, and the one other thing I wanted to say about your father, just because I found it a fascinating... fact was that as a young Foreign Service officer at the consulate, one of his jobs was to approve visas. And he in fact, it turns out that his name is signed on the bottom of Sirhan Sirhan's visa. When Sirhan, was he a Jerusalemite or a West Banker?
He was from East Jerusalem. He was from a Christian family. And in 1957, he emigrated at the age of 12 to America. And, you know, alas, 10 years later, as a very young man, he assassinated Robert F. Kennedy. And so when the assassination happened, my father completely had no memory of this, but when the assassination happened, you know, there was investigators wanted to find out when Sirhan had come, and this document emerged, and he was asked if he had any memory of it and whether, and he did not. You know, it was one of hundreds and hundreds of visa applicants that he had approved.
It's always seemed to me that one of the signs of how little known and little understood the Palestinian situation was before the 1967 war, really, is that when Kennedy was shot in 68, I guess, but even then, the Palestinian issue did not really come up all that much in the coverage. I don't think a lot of people don't remember that Sirhan was a Palestinian, or that, in fact, there were, you know, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you know, explanations in his diaries for why he had assassinated Kennedy. Anyway, let's move on and then come back to this. Kai moved to an awful lot of places. You were in Beirut, you were in Egypt, you were in Saudi Arabia. But let's talk a little bit about Nasser, who was a huge force in the Middle East in the 50s and 60s when you were there. And your description of him is, I think, different from what many people will remember, as is your description of King Hussein. So let's start with Nasser. Why was he such an important figure, and how have we misunderstood him?
This may be blasphemy, but Nasser was probably the most important Arab leader to emerge since the Prophet Muhammad.
It's only blasphemy if you said including the Prophet Muhammad.
No, since. he was, you know, a towering figure in the Middle East from the time he launched his coup against the King Farouk and came to power in 1952. And then he was elected with a massive mandate in 1956 as president. He slowly became what we would call an autocrat, a popular autocrat in the street, but nevertheless an autocrat, and with a secret police. But he was, you know, in my childhood memory as a teenager, when I was going to high school in Cairo in the 2 years leading up to the June 67 war, 65 to 67, you could see him on television, and he was mesmerizing. My Arabic wasn't good enough to understand what he was actually saying, but he was mesmerizing. He was charismatic, And one of the things I wanted to do about, you know, when I started this book was to figure out what I didn't know. You know, now I'm an historian, what I didn't know as a child growing up there. So I went back and you know, Nasser comes out as a figure. He was, first of all, a very secular man. He loved American culture. He read Time and Newsweek and Life every week. He loved Hollywood films. He had private screenings of Hollywood films. He apparently loved Jimmy Stewart's, you know, the very, the Christmas classic.
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. That was one of his favorite films. He, of course, loved Marilyn Monroe
films.
John
Hill also loves Hollywood films.
But he was a secular Arab who had this vision of uniting the Arab states under the banner of their language, the one thing that they all had in common, the sort of Arabic language and literature. And the interesting thing today, looking back, of course, is that you realize that he was, that his closest enemies at home were the Muslim Brotherhood, were young men who were motivated by sort of a politicized Islam, who were then identified as conservatives, as, you know, backward-looking people. And at this time in the Arab world, every young Arab man really aspired to enter the modern 20th century. They wanted to be educated. They wanted to be doctors and lawyers and engineers. And they thought of their identity in a multiple sense. I mean, yes, their religion might be Christian or Muslim or Coptic, or and they weren't denying their Islamic roots, but they saw their identity in as multiple pieces in a modern sense. And when, as I describe, when Nasser was defeated in June 67, not only defeated but terribly humiliated, that jeopardized jeopardized the whole sort of secular Arab nationalist movement. It no longer seemed credible or legitimate, and it opened up, I think I show quite dramatically, it opened up a sort of window, a political vacuum, which was eventually filled with jihadists motivated by a political Islam, young men today who see themselves only as Islamicists in opposition to the West.
This battle that Egypt's been fighting with the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, it went on all through Nasser's period. It led, I mean, it was, I don't know if it was Brotherhood people, but it was Islamists who killed Sadat, and it's a battle that's going on today. And the Muslim Brotherhood also led directly to the creation of Hamas. It led, I mean, I think Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's, I mean, this is just another one of those things that we often think of in this country, I think, as a recent development, maybe a post 9/11 development or something that happened before 9/11, but it's part of a battle that went on all through the 20th century.
Now, I should mention, you throw out the name of Ayman al-Zawahiri. Zawahiri is a man my age exactly, 58, and when I was growing up in Cairo, he and I lived in the same neighborhood. Same very upper-class neighborhood called Mahdi, suburb south of Cairo, right on the Nile River. And this was a neighborhood that I describe in the book as, it was founded at the turn of the century by two Jewish Egyptian developers, entrepreneurs, and it was a beautiful planned suburb with wide boulevards, tree-lined, and each house had a large garden around it, and there were not one but three or four synagogues and several mosques and churches, and even up until the late 50s, nearly half of the residents of Mahdi were Jewish Egyptians who had been there for several generations and considered themselves to be part of the Egyptian mosaic. Now, they began to leave, particularly after the 56 war, and there very few survived after the 67 war, but there were still Jews living in Mahdi when I lived there. And so I'm saying, you know, it was a very cosmopolitan place. Egypt was still a very cosmopolitan place. There were Greeks and Italians who'd been there for generations. There was a French language newspaper and several English language newspapers along with very numerous Arabic language. And Ayman Zawahiri, you know, he had the aspiration to become a medical doctor like his father. He was religious. His mother came from a line of religious mullahs. But again, he didn't start off as a terrorist. He got there.
Which of us does?
Yes. And I know I didn't ever actually meet him as a boy, but I subsequently have learned that he and I both went regularly to the Mahdi Sporting Club, where we would see on weekends Hollywood movies on a large outdoor screen. And no doubt we passed each other in the streets riding our bicycles. It was a very small place. And yet, after the 67 war, this radicalized Zawahiri to some degree, and he became more Islamicist precisely because the sort of secular Arab option seemed to have been defeated. And then after Sadat's assassination, he was implicated, not in the assassination, but in a... He had apparently agreed to store some weapons in his home for a group that was not implicated in the assassination but had similar sort of Islamic jihadist ideas. And he was tried and tortured by the Egyptian police. And he was acquitted of the Sadat assassination but convicted of the arms indictment. And this, of course, further put him over the deep end, and he eventually went to Saudi Arabia where he met bin Laden. But it's a tragedy that I sort of, again, in my Zelig-like personification, was able to write about. And so I have a different view of Egypt, but it's an Egypt that no longer exists.
So that brings me in, and maybe we can do this one sort of quickly, but King Hussein of Jordan was another figure you write about. And I would venture to say that to most Americans, King Hussein is viewed as almost a hero. I mean, he was a moderate Arab leader in a world of, you know, hardliners in Iraq and Syria and Egypt. He was our guy. He was willing to make peace with the Israelis. When he died, I mean, I think you heard from Americans that this was a great man. But in your description, he and his family, the Hashemites who were put into power after the First World War, they are puppets. They're CIA assets. They're betrayers, I think you could say, of the Palestinians. Why do we have that picture so wrong?
A lot of bad history, I would argue. Listen, when I went back to Beirut in September 1970, I was dying to get back to the Middle East. I considered it in some ways my home. And I wanted to go back to study Arabic and Middle Eastern history a little bit more at the American University of Beirut. And that, a few days after I arrived, four airplanes were hijacked by Palestinian guerrillas in the skies over Beirut. And 3 days later, a fifth airplane was hijacked. And my girlfriend at the time was on that plane. And she was kept hostage in, along with over 350 other passengers on these planes, in an abandoned desert airfield in northern Jordan for 4 days. And at the end of the fourth day, they rushed the passengers off and blew up the three planes that had landed there. And this sparked a brutal civil war in Jordan. And again, as the historian, I wanted to... I tell the story of the hijackings from the point of view of my former girlfriend, And I also interviewed a couple of the hijackers. And then I go back as an historian to try to figure out what happened afterwards. Well, there was this civil war, which was instigated by King Hussein, who was told essentially by the CIA station chief and the Nixon administration that the hijackings were now the pretext to crack down on this state within a state that had grown up, the PLO within Jordan. And over the next 2 weeks, there was brutal fighting. King Hussein's Jordanian legionnaires lobbed artillery shells directly into the refugee camps. 3,000 to 4,000 people were killed. The Palestinians fought back, and at one point, King Hussein felt his throne was really in real danger, and so he called the CIA station chief in and asked him to plead with the Israelis to provide air cover.
Which is stunning. Stunning that an Arab leader would call for Israeli air cover in a fight against the Palestinians.
Absolutely stunning that this could have happened. The really stunning thing, though, was I learned as an historian going into the archives, there was actually a serious debate inside the Israeli cabinet over whether they should comply with this request. Yes, the Nixon administration and Henry Kissinger viewed King Hussein as our plucky little king, because in the grand battle of the Cold War, he was an anti-communist, he was anti-Soviet, and he was anti-Nasser. And Nasser was regarded as too neutralist, too pro-Soviet. And so King Hussein was regarded as a steady ally. But the Israelis understood, in the Israeli cabinet at the time, that, well, yeah, he was a plucky little king, but he was a monarch ruling over a majority of Palestinians inside Jordan. He came originally, his family, the Hashemites, came from Arabia. And if he lost his throne, well, maybe that wouldn't be so bad, because then Jordan would become a Palestinian state. And Ariel Sharon and others took the view that we should let King Hussein go down and we should allow the PLO to come to power. They would then have the responsibility for managing a state that would have to sort of moderate them. And we would have a two-state solution. And so I argue in the book that this may have been the best opportunity we had for an early resolution of the whole conflict. But alas, it didn't happen. King Hussein prevailed. He expelled the PLO the refugee camps of Beirut and outside of Beirut and Lebanon, which within 4 years, instigated the brutal Lebanese civil war that lasted 15 years and killed 180,000 people and led to the growth of what we now call Hezbollah, which now today has 40,000 missiles aimed at Israel. I argue that there's a lot of many roads not taken.
And many wrong roads taken.
I would say.
So the plucky little king, was he on the CIA payroll for how long?
Oh, he was on the CIA payroll from 1957 until 1976.
He personally.
A CIA station chief or his subordinate would actually hand carry a briefcase full of cash to the palace once a month. And, he by the 70s, he was getting on the order of $750,000 a year, which he used, for his personal use in some ways, but to hire foreign bodyguards because he couldn't trust his own
thing about King Hussein, if you ask me, is that he's brought in by the West, to rule over a country, or his family was brought in to rule over a country where they had no roots. The country is majority Palestinian, and he stayed in power for what, 25, 30 years? I mean, he was...
Oh, more. Yeah, almost 50.
His grandfather was killed in 48. he he came into power. He ruled until he died, and, yeah. and his son's still in power. It's an incredible story.
And, you know, today most Jordanians, even of Palestinian ancestry, they, as students in elementary school and high school or in university, they do not read about Black September, the Civil War. It's as if it never happened.
Control the history books. Yeah, that's right? That's a good thing. So just, we don't have that much more time before I want to open it up for questions. But so you grow up with this sympathy for the Palestinians. Your parents have sympathy for the Palestinians. You're pretty sure you know what the situation is. And then all of a sudden you're confronted with these new events. Your girlfriend is taken hostage. You have to look at the violence that's being done by Palestinians. After that, you marry a woman who's Jewish, whose parents are Holocaust survivors. How do you begin to reconcile all this? Does this change your views? Are you now, you know, anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli? Do you think it's okay to hijack planes?
No, I don't think it's okay to hijack planes, but, you know, I try still to see both sides. And, you know, when I married Susan, I gradually had to get to know my in-laws. And I'll always remember, you know, the first time I was taken over to my mother-in-law's apartment in New York, Susan took me aside at one point and opened the closet door near the front door. And this closet was completely empty. There was nothing in it. My mother-in-law didn't like to have possessions. But there was one packed suitcase. She had been orphaned at the age of 16 and escaped on her own from first Austria to Yugoslavia, then to Italy. And, you know, that she was ready to flee if there was another pogrom, another Shoah, and that was the lesson that she took. It was an enormous burden. And, you know, my wife grew up really not knowing the story of how the details of how her parents survived. And that's typical, too, I've learned of Holocaust survivors. They try to protect their children and insulate them from the awfulness of it. But inevitably, they convey a certain dread and a burden and an expectation, you know, that they have to be watchful. And so as the years went by, I actually sat my in-laws down and interviewed them on tape and got their story. And my mother-in-law's story is fantastic. She eventually, at the age of 17, was recruited by the Italian resistance in Rome and became a spy in the German army headquarters, posing as a secretary, filching blank ID cards. And Susan's father was... you know, escaped to Italy, but then was picked up and put in a concentration camp in southern Italy. Susan's grandfather was bludgeoned to death in a concentration camp in Yugoslavia. And, you know, you can't listen to those stories without feeling an enormous sympathy and dread about it.
Were they Zionists?
Were they Zionists? My father-in-law certainly was. Helma.
You found that out.
Yeah. My mother-in-law is sort of more apolitical. She's a survivor. She wanted to survive, and she got a visa to America and came to America because that was the first place she could go to. But you know, I tell the story at the end of the book. About going back to Jerusalem and looking up an old childhood neighbor who is a lovely man his name is Sari Nusebi, and he's a British-trained philosopher. And one day he heard a knock at the door of his home in East Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah, my old childhood neighborhood. And he opened the door, and there was the retired head of Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence organization that's responsible for controlling Palestinians in the occupied territories and arresting them and imprisoning them. And Ami Ayalon was standing there in the doorway, and he said to Sari, I have a one-page peace plan, 7 points, and I've gone around to some of my Palestinian contacts, and they say that you're the only Palestinian crazy enough to sign this document with me. And Sari looked at it and actually spent a few weeks studying it and wondering whether he should add his name to it. But he did. And now 250,000 Israelis have signed this document and a slightly fewer number of Palestinians in the West Bank. And it's a plan that I think, you know, all commonsensical people could understand and agree to. There should be two states with the green line, the 1967 border, separating them, and with an exchange of land on a one-to-one basis to take into account, you know, facts created on the ground. And that Jerusalem would be the shared capital of both states. And there would be a commission established to provide compensation to the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and to settle them in the new Palestinian state. And, you know, this is what should happen. It's probably what will happen. But alas, we're not there. And we're not there, I explain in the book, because both sides are still unwilling to engage with the historical narrative of their neighbor. The Israelis, you know, say that they are the victims of the Shoah, and the Palestinians say they're the victims of the Nakba. And, you know.
So let me interrupt you right there and ask you before we stop to tell two stories about that historical narrative, because you have these two parallel stories, which I thought were very moving, and they show how in some ways the stories are similar between for both sides. And one is the story of Vikin
Kalbian, yes,
going back to his house, and the other story is the story of your mother-in-law going back to her house.
Well, when my wife, Susan, was 12 years old, her mother, Helma, took her back to Graz, Austria, and made a point of taking her to see the villa in which she had been raised and which had been seized by a Nazi party official right after Kristallnacht in 1938. And she knocks on the door, and the door opens, and there is George Marguch, the Nazi. And so Helma says to Mr. Marguch, "Well, you may remember me. I used to live here as a little girl, and this is my daughter, and I'd like to show her where I lived. Can we walk around the house a bit?" A very awkward moment, of course, but he invited them in, and indeed, there were some of the same artwork was on the walls. Some of the same furniture was there. Susan has a vivid memory of the tension in the room. Yes. And I should say Helma did try to get her property back after the war, but she was penniless, and she wrote a letter to the Graz courts, never heard, so she ended up arriving in New York City with $40 in her pocket and, you know, made her way in life as an American, and just thought it was hopeless to get anything back. And indeed, she tried, and again, when the Austrian government finally set up a commission for restitution, the Austrians had always said, "Oh, no, you know, this wasn't our fault. It was the Germans who did this. We were invaded by the Germans." Well, finally, the Clinton administration, in the last year of its life, persuaded the Austrians to establish a commission, set aside $250 million, and they invited people like my mother-in-law to apply for restitution. And the sad story is that she had all the documents to prove that she had lived in this house and her father had paid taxes, and they agreed, yes, that was your house. But Mr. Marguch had hired a lawyer and forged documents to show that in 1950, long after Helma had come to New York, forged documents to show that she had renounced any claim to the property in exchange for a small amount of money. and it was all a lie, but you know, the Austrians rejected her application. Well, then I tell later in the book a story about our next-door neighbor, Dr. Vikan Kalbian, whose family had lived for generations in Jerusalem. They were of Armenian descent in a religious sense, but they were Palestinians in their other identity. And when the 48 war happened, they were living in a fine old Arab mansion with this Jerusalem gleaming white stone in the neighborhood of Talbiya in western Jerusalem. And they vividly remember the Haganah coming around with trucks mounted with loudspeakers, demanding, warning the Palestinian population, you have to flee. It's your lives are in danger. You have to leave now. And they packed a suitcase and walked out thinking maybe they'd be back in a few weeks when the war, you know, when things had settled down. And that was 1948. And in 1967, after the June War, the Chaldeans had eventually settled in Sheikh Jarrah and in East Jerusalem. But after the 67 War, he went back and knocked on the door.
After the 67 War, the Mandelbaum Gate is no
Mandelbaum
more.
Gate
People
was,
can go back and forth.
Exactly, yeah. No, one of the first things the Israelis did after the June War was to take bulldozers and knock down the remnants of Mandelbaum Gate. You can't, it's hard to find it now. They wanted no memory of, you know, the divided city. Anyway, Dr. Kalbian went back to his old house in Talbiya and knocked on the door. It's number 4 Balfour Street. And the door opens and there's a Jewish Turk who had come after 48 to Israel, and he said, ah, he had heard Kalbian speaking in English to his young daughter describing the house. He said, ah, you must be Dr. Kalbian. And he said, oh, all my neighbors have had visits from Palestinians in East Jerusalem wanting to see their old homes. And he invited Kalbian into the house, and there was still the chandelier that he remembered as a child. They went out in the back garden, and there was an apricot tree that Vikan had planted when he was a young boy in the 1930s. And you know, it was a very moving moment. And at one point, the current owner of the house, this Turk of Jewish ancestry, said, well, you know, I bought this house from the authorities. And Vikan said, oh. and indeed, the Israelis had set up an absentee landlord commission. So any Palestinians that fled and you know, didn't come back, and most of them didn't come back, they actually set up a system where you could apply for restitution for your property if you had not fled to an enemy state. That's the way. Well, Jordan was an enemy state. Lebanon,
Egypt,
Syria.
Right. Okay. We're all enemy
the
states.
Only Arab state that was not an enemy state in 1948, oddly enough, was the Kingdom of Libya.
Well, so, they do have refugee camps. There were Palestinians who fled to Libya.
There were. And in fact, Dr. Kalbian tells me that he has one friend who fled directly to Libya, and he could prove this. And
got his house back.
And he was able to, he didn't ever get his house back, this guy, but he was able to.
The part of that story that was moving to me when I read it was, as the way you described it, was that the Turkish guy who's in the house says, oh, and do you want to see your tree? And Kalbian says, what? He says, well, you'll want to see your tree. And he takes him out back and he shows him this tree. And he says, everybody knows the story about how the Kalbian boy planted this tree, mm-hmm. which was really moving to me. All right, let's break it off there and see if there are any questions. Guy, there's someone here with a microphone hold. You can, if you talk loud, we'll hear you.
Gleb Pasha is a famous figure in Palestine before the war and after. In the 50s, he was an advisor to King Hussein and trained the Arab legionnaires. And, but I'm not quite sure what your question was. Oh, I see. Well, I would discount that. I mean, Gleb Pasha was very close to the Hashemite family, to King Abdullah at the time. And I think he probably did his best to give the Arab legionnaires good advice. But, you know, that war was won by the Israelis because they were fighting on their turf for the establishment of their state, and they were much better organized. And it's hard to I would think it's hard to blame Gleb Pasha for the outcome.
Giving it away.
Hi, I really enjoyed your talk, and to put a human face on these incredible historical events is something like it's just thrilling, and thank you so much for writing this novel, this memoir. Okay, when I was a very young girl, I'm a little older than you, I read a book, and it was about the Mandelbaum Gate, and I must have been a teenager, so it must have been written in the 50s, and it was a thriller, it was a novel. Do you remember at all what that book was, who the author was? It was the only other reference. When I saw it said Mandelbaum Gate, I got all excited. It was the only time right. in 50 years I had heard that phrase, or because it has been erased. I was in Israel in the 70s, and it's gone. You can't find it. It's just not there. So do you know anything at all about this novel? Have you ever heard of it?
Yes, it's a very well-known novel.
Good.
I think it was published in the mid-60s or early 60s, and maybe late 50s. By a woman, and what was her name? Does anyone remember? But it was a novel. It was a thriller set in Jerusalem, Palestine at the time.
Was it Muriel Sparks?
Exactly. Muriel Sparks, yes.
Muriel Sparks?
Exactly. We have readers in this audience.
That's right. Who else? There's a guy.
Thank you. 400 years ago, Pascal wrote, there's nothing men do with greater zeal or greater joy than the evil they do out of religious conviction. Mm. So I was hoping you might share with us some ray of sunshine. Do you see any resolution of the strife in the Middle East that's going on in perpetuity?
Well, you know, let me first say, you know, my book is not about today, per se. Yeah, it's a memoir about my childhood and roads not taken, what ifs. But you know, I'm an optimistic guy, maybe naively so. But I do think the Sari Nusseibeh Ami Ayalon plan is what is going to happen eventually. It could happen tomorrow if we had the political will and leadership. And it probably won't. But, you know, unfortunately, we're, you know, the Middle East of my childhood, the Arab world of my childhood, is much more drenched in messianic religiosity than it was then. And I mourn for my old Arab world in that sense. On the other hand, I do quote a famous Syrian philosopher who's still alive and lives in Damascus named Sadiq al-Azam. Unfortunately, al-Azam has written most of his books in Arabic, but he's a courageous, secular critic of the Islamicists. And he argues that that the jihadists who carried out 9/11 had their high point really probably on 9/11. And that since their appeal is on a downward slope, that political Islam can't put bread on the table, can't bring the Arab world into the 21st century, like Nasser was trying to secularize it in terms of the Arab nationalist movement of his time. And they're going to be defeated, and they'll just have fewer young, angry Arab men believe that this is a solution. On the other hand, so as the Arab world has undergone a process of religiosity, so too has Israel. So oddly enough, in Israel today, you know, Tel Aviv and the strip of the Mediterranean in Israel, where most Israelis live, is very vibrant and modern and secular, and most Israelis don't attend shul or temple or synagogue on except for high holidays, and they're highly educated and productive, and many Israelis are, you know, doing very well in the high tech industry now. You know, if there is ever peace, this part of the world is going to just undergo a huge economic boom. And yet, in Israel today, 25% of all first graders who are Israeli citizens, I'm not speaking about people in, you know, Palestinians in the West Bank, Israeli citizens, 25% come from families of either Orthodox or ultra-nationalist Orthodox families, drenched in religion. And a lot of them, of these families, you know, live in Jerusalem or around Jerusalem or in the West Bank settlements. And yet another 25% of all Israeli first graders are Christian or Muslim Palestinians who have citizenship. So, you know, that shows you the sort of demographic train wreck that we're going to experience in 10, 15 years. And if we don't seize the opportunity in the very near future, in the next few years, you know, within 5 years, even 5 years may be very difficult. I mean, the option for a two-state solution is going to become much, much harder.
For demographic reasons?
For demographic reasons, because if you look at all the people who live in Gaza, inside Israel proper, inside the Green Line, and in the West Bank, within 5 years, a majority of those people will be Palestinians. So then Israel's, if it doesn't find a way to carve out a two-state solution, it's going to have to grapple with the question, is it going to be a democratic state or not?
One of the things that you do so nicely in the book is to describe this secular Palestinian world in Jerusalem when you were growing up. And admittedly, it's among, you know, educated and elite people who your family was socializing with. But there's this whole world of Palestinian secular intellectuals educated in, you know, in England and in the United States. And you know, by the time I got to Jerusalem, much of that was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Yeah, it's coming.
I was here maybe a month or two ago, and there was an Amy Willens, and there were three authors,
Her.
Experience in the Middle East, writing about the Middle East for some years, and they really argued against the two-state solution, saying it would never work, and that was pretty much the thrust of the evening. And then I was in Israel about 3 years ago, and I went into the old city in Jerusalem and talked to Christians, Muslims, Palestinian Muslims, and Jews. I had 2 full days to just sort of wander around in there, and I always asked the same question to people when we got in conversations: do you think there's a solution? And there wasn't one person I talked to that thought there was any solution. I mean, they were willing to live there because they were very holy people, and they just wanted to be right there at the source, but none of them really held any hope for any kind of resolution to the conflict.
Can I answer that for a moment? I mean, Kai told you about this, sorry, Nusebe, Ami Ayalon agreement. I mean, the reality of the Middle East is that almost everybody knows the outlines of the solution. Everyone knows what's going to what has to happen. Everyone knows what's the fair answer, and yet no one has the will to make it happen. No one has the Netanyahu comes to power with a weak coalition, and he can't do it, or he doesn't want to, or Shimon Peres is determined to do it, but he loses power because of a battle in Beirut or a war in Gaza. But anyone who's ever walked the streets of Jerusalem understands that there's a very clear line there down which that city will ultimately be divided. Finding the solution is not the problem. It's bringing it to pass that's difficult. And it is true. When that evening when you were here, there was a guy named Sari Makdisi here. And Sari is a very, very articulate opponent of the peace process as we know it. He believes that the only fair solution is for there to be one single secular democratic state in the territory that will, allow, and all people can be citizens of it, and that as long as you have an Israel, it's going to be an unfair, racist state. That's Sari's point of view. I disagree with that, strongly. I think that the two-state solution, difficult to achieve. It's going to be problematic. There are these demographic pressures. If you don't have a two-state solution, as Kai points out, there's a terrible demographic pressure. But if you do have one, there's a demographic pressure as well, because the number of Israeli Arabs or Israeli Palestinians who live within Israel proper is also growing at a pace that will ultimately outgrow the number of Jews. So I'm not. It's not going to be easy, but I believe that the two-state solution is the only workable thing. Do you want to say anything to that, Kai?
Oh, I would just quickly add that whether it's a two-state or a one-state solution, you'd want to see not a cold peace. You'd want to see a real peace, a warm peace, where if Jerusalem is a shared capital, we wouldn't have to return to the days of Mandelbaum Gate with barbed wire. You'd see a city that was still open, and where people could go back and forth and trade. And, it's a very small piece of territory and land, and these people inevitably have to be neighbors. And, this is the 21st century, and it should be, whether it's one state or two state, eventually it's got to be basically secular, respectful of all religions, but there have got to be secular rules. And finally, in the end, as we go through the 21st century, I think we're going to find in an age of globalization that our notions of and definitions of sovereignty are going to really become very porous. And I think that's a good thing.
Where?
One or two more questions?
Yeah, sure.
Given that the United States is apparently regarded as Israel's great and good friend, what does it take to restore us as a fair arbiter in this situation? I mean, it makes us sound like we have no role here, and yet that's hard to believe. I think in the Arab world, there's a lot of outcry for the United States to, play a much more forceful role here.
Right. Well, you know, we're not only Israel's great benefactor and have on numerous occasions vetoed UN resolutions that Israel doesn't like, but we are also the benefactor of Arab kings and dictators. And that, too, has sullied our hands in this way. We're much too involved in this region. It's, you know, we're, you know, I grew up in Egypt, and now Sadat's successor, another Egyptian army officer, Mubarak, has been in power for nearly 30 years, and every year he gets $2 or $3 billion from us. And, you know, the elections there are a joke. And he imprisons not only Muslim Brotherhood types and Islamicists, but also secular Democrats, intellectuals who want to have free speech and want to be able to write newspapers freely. He puts them in prison too. And he's just recently, last week, extended for another 2 years their emergency laws. And, you know, he's going to get another, I think it's $3 billion these years, no? About $3
billion. $3 billion every year.
And, you know, we also have a very odd relationship with the Saudis.
We didn't get to talk about the part of Kai's book that's about Saudi Arabia, which is a really fascinating description of the American role when you were growing up there in Saudi Arabia and just how intertwined we've been with that monarchy over the years.
So the bottom line is, I think, you know, we should... Well, I don't know. I throw this out. It would be good if we could find a way to say, okay, we're tired of this issue. It's become too much in terms of blood and treasure. Let's reconvene a Geneva conference. Let's bring the international community in to solve this once and for all. Let's take the Nusaybe Ayalon plan and submit it as a referendum to the Israelis and to the Palestinians now. And let's get a two-state solution. You know, I think it's going to take not us, but the whole international community to become involved. And, you know, there are good signs, too. There's something called J Street now in Washington, D.C., that started a year ago, and you know, they're a sort of new, younger organization of Jewish Americans who proclaim themselves to be pro-Israel and pro-peace. And they are very much in favor of a two-state solution. They're in favor of Barack Obama's insistence that the settlements stop, not only in the West Bank, but in East Jerusalem and Sheikh Jarrah as well. And this is a hopeful sign that people are becoming engaged and vocal.
Okay, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Kai's going to sign books, though.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.